Welcome to OncoPharm. I'm your host, John Bazar. I'm a professor of pharmacy practice here at the supporting sponsor of OncoPharm, ETSU's Bill Gatton College of Pharmacy. It is really one of the great days. It's March 28th, 2024. Sweet 16 basketball in the basketball tournament here, and also opening day for Major League Baseball. One of the reasons I said beginning of the month, March is one of my favorite months. Apologies for last week not having an episode. We had ACP here doing a site accreditation visit that seemed to go just great. So was too busy last week with that to do a podcast with other responsibilities. So we have four papers I'm going to talk about today in varying levels of depth that I found interesting from the last couple weeks. The first one is ECOG Acron E2810. This is a really fascinating study. So this is in renal cell carcinoma patients who have an isolated site of metastatic disease, oligometastatic disease, and they have a metastatectomy, which is one of my favorite words, metastatectomy. So the surgeons go in and they just take out the lung nodule, the metastatic lung nodule, and then they have no evidence of disease. But they had metastatic disease, right? So metastatic disease, probably not curable, but there's no evidence of disease. So what do we do for treatment? So at the time that this study was done, we really did not have any answers about systemic treatment. Since then, we've had the adjuvant pembrolizumab study where a lot of those patients were actually just like this. Metastatic disease who had metastatectomy. And oh, by the way, huge benefit in pembrolizumab for those patients. This study is looking at a relatively small number of patients, 129, who with renal cell carcinoma, clear cell, who had a metastatectomy, and then they're randomized to pazopanib for 52 weeks. So basically for 52 weeks of pazopanib or placebo. So they're doing this, you know, pazopanib for like a year or placebo. I think, 52 weeks is a year, right? So a year pazopanib or placebo, all right? And what you would expect is that, you know, my prior assumption would be, we'll see, you know, an improvement in disease-free survival, right? The people on placebo have their cancer come back, but there's no difference in overall survival. That would have been my assumption, right? Gosh, would I have been wrong? And if that was your assumption, you would have been wrong too. So what we see here is absolutely no difference in disease-free survival. So, you know, almost all these folks by 24 months, right? So now we're out to 2 years. No, yeah, yeah. 2 years, 24 months. A lot of these folks have had their disease come back. Absolutely no difference in disease-free survival getting this, what they're calling, this 52 weeks of pazopanib. Right, so no difference. However, for overall survival, there was a detriment of pazopanib. The hazard ratio for death was 2.55. So much more death in the pazopanib arm than the placebo arm. And so they did not track, like, what, unfortunately, what therapy these folks got when their disease came back, right? So, but certainly one of the concerns would be that, and they actually hypothesized this, or at least mentioned it, is that, you know, perhaps some of these folks are having, we're making it harder to treat. We're selecting for pazopanib-resistant tumor cells, and there's even some concern that maybe we're having some T cell exhaustion with this pazopanib activity. It's certainly not helpful. And so right away we know from this, if you've had a metastatectomy, don't put them on pazopanib and probably another VEGF TKI. And if you do treatment, it seems like an immune checkpoint inhibitor based on that adjuvant pembro study makes the most sense, although I think only 60 of those patients in that arm were M1, no evidence of disease. So not a ton of data. This was a cooperative group study. I'm not sure we'll get any better or higher quality data. So this is probably what we have to go with to make decisions. All right, so let's move on and talk about pancreatic cancer. So metastatic pancreatic cancer, we have had, you know, gemcitabine got approved, quality of life benefit, little OS benefit, over 5 if you. Then we get gem plus nab-paclitaxel. Then we get FOLFIRI, which is better than gemcitabine. This is a French study, Prodish 65, and there's a whole bunch, 36 gempax unicancer study. This is looking at... This is looking at gemcitabine versus gemcitabine plus paclitaxel, not nab-paclitaxel, just conventional paclitaxel. And what they say in this study, like their rationale for doing this is, yeah, we know that nab-paclitaxel is better than gemcitabine, but, quote, hypothetically, nab-paclitaxel enhances paclitaxel tissue distribution and tumor penetration, but its superiority over solvent-based conventional paclitaxel is still controversial regardless of the indication, and they give a couple citations. As such, the French authorities did not issue a favorable opinion for nab-paclitaxel reimbursement. Essentially what they're saying here, in France, we don't have access to this, is what it sounds like, to nab-paclitaxel. So we're going to do gemcitabine compared to gemcitabine plus paclitaxel. And we see the median overall survival for gemcitabine is 5.6 months, pretty much what you would expect for metastatic pancreas cancer is about 6 months. That's kind of what we see in all these gemcitabine single-arm studies, or when gemcitabine is compared to gem plus Abraxane, maybe it's in 6 to 7 months. So this is reasonable, right? 5.9 months with single-agent gemcitabine. Gemcitabine plus paclitaxel, median OS is 6.4 months. Basically the same, right? No improvement here. And this is, a study of about 200 patients. So a decent-sized study for oncology purposes certainly adds more of that evidence that there really is something about the nab-paclitaxel, perhaps actually improving tissue distribution that formulation of paclitaxel to the cancer cells. Because we know pancreatic cancer are hard to treat. And that brings me to my next study, which is also, I think, a French study. It's PRODIGE24/CCTCPA6. This is a cool study. I find it kind of cool. Now, this is not ready for prime time. So what these authors have done in the past is they've developed this this assay that's a gene, basically an RNA signature, not a gene signature, but an RNA signature to predict basically cancer susceptibility to gemcitabine. All right. And so basically they do this study and they have their control population and they're able to identify that this group, this assay, this RNA assay, is able to identify people who really are not going to benefit from gemcitabine. Okay. Now, there have been lots and lots of genes and things over the years that have said this will predict response of this drug or that drug or prevent resistance, and they haven't always made it to prime time. So, I don't know if this is going to make it to prime time, but, this was a phase 3 study, and they looked, they used those patients and then, had their blood and played with afterwards, it looks like, to figure out, was this assay predictive? And I kind of want to talk about, what this RNA signature is in case this does become forward. But they're really looking at a whole bunch of genes that control the expression of what looks like two main genes. So one is the human equilibrative nucleoside transporter, which is a transmembrane glycoprotein. That is how gemcitabine gets into the cells, right? That's how it gets into the pancreatic cancer cells, right? So once gemcitabine gets into the cell, it doesn't do anything, right? It has to be phosphorylated, right? Because it's basically a false base pair. So they're also looking at expression of deoxycytidine kinase, which is going to lead to this gemcitabine monophosphate that's going to gunk up DNA, pharmacologically speaking. So it's really looking at a whole bunch of genes that control for the expression of, the main gene of gemcitabine getting into the pancreatic cancer cell, and then the phosphorylation for the active metabolite. And what, kind of the big take-home results of this are, because this is a study of gemcitabine compared to modified FOLFIRINOX, and really the folks getting, gemcitabine do just as well as modified FOLFIRINOX if they actually have, are positive for this assay that predicts sensitivity. But if they're negative, they don't get any benefit from gemcitabine. And kind of what this could tell you is if you're maybe negative for this assay, again, this is not quite ready for prime time, I don't think, but if you get a negative report on this RNA assay, you probably should certainly get modified FOLFIRINOX, which is probably what we'd do anyway if you had a good performance status. But if you're positive for this, you might be able to do just as well with gemcitabine, which is going to be much better tolerated than a FOLFIRINOX-based regimen. So, hopefully this is something that, maybe gets a prospective validated study is kind of what we would want to see. For this to go prime time, this is in the methods that you use this to determine drug therapy, which is what we did to establish Oncotype or not onco, yeah, Oncotype in breast cancer patients to determine adjuvant treatment that we can, that we need it or we can skip it. You'd have to incorporate it into the method and test that methodology for it to be, boom, ready for prime time, you know, big category one recommendation. That's kind of what I think we would need. So I don't know if it's something that's going to start to make its way into practice on the edges, but perhaps kind of interesting to look at, and I'll have all these links in the show notes. All right, the last study I have to talk about is, I'm actually only going to link to the editorial, but there were two small, you know, we're talking 12 and 8 patients respectively, really case series of patients with mostly non-melanoma skin cancer, like cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, in the setting of a kidney transplant. So these patients, you know, traditionally drugs like immune checkpoint inhibitors work well for these types of skin cancers. Unfortunately, they work by upregulating the immune system and increasing T cell activity, and that could lead to kidney graft loss in these kidney transplant patients. So there was one study where they looked at, you know, they were on tacrolimus and prednisone to prevent kidney graft rejection, and they put them on nivolumab, and if that didn't work, they added ipilimumab, and there was quite a bit of graft loss, like the kidneys, you know, were rejected by this upregulation of the immune system. There was another small study where the where their immunosuppressant regimen was everolimus or sirolimus, an mTOR inhibitor, which has a lot more toxicity probably than even a tacro prednisone regimen, plus some pulse steroids, and using just cemiplimab, so just a PD-1 ligand access inhibitor without graft loss, and seemed to do pretty well. Now again, it's a small study, but this is you know, a scenario where you have kidney transplant population, very specific, almost niche population, and they have you know, a skin cancer. So you're not going to get a lot of data probably in this scenario, and probably not something that I would. I'm not even going into great depth on it because it might go years before I actually encounter this scenario. But I know it's there, and there's been at least some preliminary, you know, discussion about what to do and some data to guide your decision making. And so I'll have this in the show notes, and if probably I'll encounter this probably in 3 months after I just said I won't see it for years. And I'll go back into my show notes and I'll find it. That's kind of how I use the podcast feed sometimes for myself, even to go back and find these things as almost a bibliography. So that is what I have for you this week. Thank you so much for listening. I will do my best to put something together for next week in advance to drop. I will be out of town at HOPA in Tampa for the Hematology Oncology Pharmacy Association annual meeting. So if you're a listener of the podcast and see me there, say hey. I always enjoy people. I always enjoy hearing nice things about the podcast, as anyone would, I suppose. So thank you for listening. You can follow me on the app, formerly known as Twitter, at PharmDeetNib. And then you can follow the podcast on X, Threads, and Instagram at OncoPharmPod. And until I talk to you again, remember, doses matter. Thank you.